I'm Grant, an engineering and technology leader who will share the secrets of IT with you. Listen up, because we're about to get into it. Hey everyone, welcome to Getting Into It with Grant. Today I have another guest to share with you. His name's Steve Toy, and he's the CEO of Memrise. Memrise is a language learning company in the same space as companies like Duolingo and Rosetta Stone, if you've ever heard of them. Memrise has a unique approach to learning new languages and helping people better communicate with one another. They may have started out as quote-unquote just another flashcard app, as I've heard Steve say before, but they've evolved into something very different these days, in my opinion. Yes, mere mortals like you and I still have to put in work to learn a language, but with the advent of AI, there are a lot of new ways to reduce the burden on the language learner and immerse them in the language to accelerate the learning process and meet them where their skill level is at. The way Memrise is doing that is one of the things that I got to talk to Steve about. As a user of Memrise myself, and also Duolingo and Rosetta Stone, I can confidently say that Memrise is the biggest bang for your buck. And no, this podcast episode is not sponsored. I'm just a language nerd and found their product useful. It's frustrating to use a product like Duolingo or others, and then eventually hit that plateau where you can't really go much farther due to the lack of immersion or lack of vocabulary. And that real life use of the language is the key to making progress from amateur to novice. At least it is for me. I get tired of looking at flashcards over and over and over again and doing the same kinds of exercises with slightly different variations of vocabulary. So while I may start off strong trying to learn a language, it eventually kind of dies out because I don't have any way of using that language in real life. And so this is a topic that Steve touches on as well. So the information that we talked about was fascinating to me. So buckle up, we're going to go on a journey and learn about running a business, using technology as your platform to run a learning company, and how ChatGPT, GPT 3.5, and AI in general is impacting the tech landscape. So if you're looking to learn a language, give Memrise a try at memrise.com, M-E-M-R-I-S-E.com, and enjoy our conversation. All right. Excellent. Well, Steve, thank you so much for joining me on this episode of Getting Into It with Grant. I was very pleased to have you on the episode and kind of coordinate this thing that we're doing today. So thank you so much for spending your time with me today.
Yeah, thanks for having me. It's great to be here.
Yeah, absolutely. So I will have done a proper introduction of you in the intro to this episode. But if you don't mind, just tell us a little bit about yourself and your role at Memrise.
Sure. Well, my official title here at Memrise is CEO, but we are a relatively small company, sort of under 70 in size in terms of people. And as a result, I'm a little bit of a, you know, more of a hands-on CEO than one you might find at a much, much bigger company. So jack of all trades in many respects, touching every part of the organization. But that kind of fits in with my, you know, professional history, where I have done similar roles in lots of different companies. Immediately prior to this, a company called Apollon, that was a portfolio of mobile apps within the IAC empire. And prior to that, I was doing interesting AI projects at Ernst & Young, where I was resided for a year because I sold a company I was running prior to that to Ernst & Young, a company called TaxChat, which was a two-sided marketplace, much like Uber, but pairing tax filers with tax preparers. And beyond that, I've worked at, you know, online travel agencies like Fairportal and business brands like Billboard and run digital media agencies. So I've just been a tech guy and jack of all trades for most of my life.
Yeah, no kidding. That's a lot of different industries you've been a part of.
Yeah.
So what is it then? Because you were one of the founders of Memrise, right?
No,
so
I'm actually relatively new to the party. Okay. Memrise was founded in 2010 mm-hmm. by three guys that all went to Oxford together.
Okay.
Ed Cook and Greg Detra and Ben Whateley. And they came up with the original idea and got Memrise going and scaled it up to, you know, a good size. And then I was brought in in a consulting type role in 2020, right near the pandemic, but took over as CEO in July of 2021. So okay. That's where my journey in earnest as CEO has begun with Memrise.
Okay, so that really threw you a curveball then, coming in as CEO and then immediately COVID changing how the world operates to be much more digitally focused, right?
Yeah, I think the big issue was being much more remote. We mm-hmm. were a tech company that built a mobile app that provided a service to all of our users remotely, right, to their phones. So we didn't have personal one-to-one contact with our end user. But as a company, everybody was in the office 5 days a week and located in and around the London area. And all of the sudden, everybody was at home with all of the attendant stresses that goes with it. And we were not an organization that had a remote infrastructure, right? So even the very basics of scrambling to get Zoom accounts and setting up, good practices and procedures for how do you communicate when you can't all sit in a room together. So that was a little bit tricky given that we were 100% in the office at the start of the pandemic.
Yeah, wow. That's a huge change in your business. Do you think that us having to go more to a Zoom-based platform there for a couple of years, do you think that helped or hurt the business of Memrise?
Well, I think it was something that we, like everybody else, had to get used to. And mm-hmm. I think that my personal feeling about mm-hmm. remote working, which I've been doing for a very long time, since I was working back in Silicon Valley in the early 2000s. And my personal feeling is that when you work with remote teams, you do have to be better at defining what it is that you want done. You mm-hmm. need to be better with specifications. You need to be better at being very clear about what good looks like. And that's a discipline that really should be in place, even if you're sitting side by side. But we often don't do those good disciplines because we are sitting side by side and we can just, turn around and ask the next person about what this is or what that is. And so there is a certain amount of getting better at defining things, being more clear and more precise about what it is we want to build and why, that is thrust upon you when you are in a remote situation. And so I would say that that's where the lemonade is in the lemons of the pandemic that thrust us into an all remote situation, is getting better at being clear about what it is we want to accomplish and by when. So that was a benefit.
Okay. Because I could see it going either way, right? I would think for Memrise, and this is just a complete and total guess, but people who are traveling across the world would use it obviously to learn languages of the mm-hmm. places that they're moving to. And during the pandemic, there was a lot less travel, but there was a lot more online communication. And so right. those language skills are still useful. Right. I think just globally, do you think, I guess, in the charts that you look at, did that drive more users to Memrise, or did you just stay the typical number of users per year that you would expect to be joining the company as like a customer?
Yeah, one thing about our business that has a similar pattern in, say, the gym business, mm-hmm. it is this. Every New Year's, everybody makes a resolution to get to the gym and learn that language. So during New Year's, there is a spike in our business, as there is in Duolingos and Babbels and Busuu's and Monly and Drops and everybody else, because of that mode. When the pandemic hit, everybody did a similar thing. They're like, all right, we're going to be home for 8 weeks. I'm going to take this time to learn a new language. It'll be cool. Spend 8 weeks working on this language. We'll come out of lockdown and everything will be awesome. Well, it was a little longer than 8 weeks. And so what I think we all saw was a spike similar to what we see in New Year's. But we didn't see a long sustained change to our business, either up or down. Things sort of stayed pretty much the same with this little bit of spike at the beginning of the pandemic. And what that tells us is that the need for learning another language certainly transcends travel. And to the extent that travel is a big component of it, the remote travel that we do through Zoom seem to have replaced the physical travel that people were unable to do because we couldn't see a glitch in the numbers of registered users.
Okay, interesting. That makes complete logical sense once you explain it. So with that then, if you've got peaks in your user base, like in January or at the start of COVID, your technology backend has to support that scale, right? Those peaks and those valleys, otherwise you'll get like degraded performance. So do you know, is there anything in particular that you do with your infrastructure to scale it for those types of events?
Yeah, I mean, we do the same thing that most do, which is we use best-in-class scalable cloud-hosted services like AWS and set ourselves up so that should we get hit by an influx of traffic, we can handle it. Our peaks and troughs aren't so crazy as to really, really even remotely test the limits of a Google Cloud platform or an AWS platform. We absolutely have peaks and troughs, but they just are so far within the scalability and capability of these, you know, cloud-based services that it's really not one of the bigger things that we have to think about in our business.
Awesome. Sounds like you've done auto-scaling appropriately then.
So far, for the level that we test it, we seem to be okay.
All right. Very good. So since you've been with the company for probably a little over 3 years at this point in time, what would you say has been your biggest success in running the business?
Well, I would absolutely say that we as a business have always believed that the best way to learn a language is to go in country and survive. And kind of anybody who's ever learned a language and traveled kind of knows that that's true. You learn more French in 2 weeks in France than you do in 2 years in high school French. It's just, you know, the reality of it. And we all kind of understand it. And we don't even need lots of academic studies to tell us it's true. And the reason that that is true is because when we're in country, we learn words like you do with our platform in Duolingo and other places. But then you're thrust into a world where you're hearing those words at different speeds, with different accents and different contexts, with different words that you don't know surrounding them. And you have to start to get really good at decoding these sound waves that are hitting your ears in and amongst all of that noise. And that's necessary for a necessary step in the process. And then you actually have to use the language. When people are learning a language with us or in many other ways, they don't want to speak the language early in the learning journey because, quite frankly, they're afraid that people are going to think they sound like a five-year-old. Because they're going to sound like a five-year-old, right? That's just the reality. But nobody's actually judging you to be stupid. They're just like, oh, okay, you're early in the learning journey. But our, you know, primitive minds can't get over the fact that, you know, other people might be judging us. So we tend not to use the words early in the journey. But when you're in country, if you want a sandwich, you're going to have to use the words. And pretty soon your desire for a sandwich or a beer or a train ticket overrides your concern that people are going to judge you. So you use the words. What we were really, really good at 3 years ago is helping people memorize words, as the name of the company suggests. And one of our founders was a grandmaster memory champion. And was a key player in the book Moonwalking with Einstein that was written about, you know, memory contests. And we were really good at that, but that immerse where you could hear words and that communicate where you were forced to say words are encouraged to say words, wasn't really part of the product, even though it was definitely part of our pedagogy. And when I joined, I happened to join at a great point in time in technological development, where all of these AI tools are coming into fruition, and we can use them to do amazing things. So we did two. The first thing that we did was we started using these tools to break down the words and phrases in the infinite content that's already out in the world, like YouTube and TikTok. And when we break it down, a video down into its words and phrases, we can compare it to our dictionary, and then we can compare it to the words that you have learned by using our product. And when we do that, we can essentially filter the world's content based on the words that you have learned in your learning journey, whatever they may be. You don't have to learn words in a certain order. It's just the words that you have learned. We can now filter video that you have a chance of understanding. And that's a really, really important part of getting people to immerse themselves in video, is it has to be within their grasp of being able to understand. Once we do that, we need enough video, enough interesting video to hold your attention, right? And we can never make that quantity of video ourselves. And quite frankly, if we could make super, super interesting videos, we'd be, you know, producers for Netflix, because that's where real money is made, right?
Yeah.
So what we've done is, by ingesting YouTube videos and TikTok videos quickly at scale with on these technologies, we can filter based on the words you've learned and get enough content. So if you want to learn French with football, you can. If somebody else wants to learn Italian with cooking, they can. If somebody else wants to learn Spanish with music videos, they can. And this way we can keep your interest. So that's the number one thing that we did. And the second thing that we did is, early on in the GPT-3 era, back in, we started in 2020, we started saying, how can we use this technology to help people communicate with these words? And we went ahead and built a chatbot that we call Membot, that speaks 15 different languages. And when you pair these languages, it's 100 different language pairs that our chatbot can speak. And we have all kinds of missions that you can do to help you practice using the language. And that gets us the communicate leg of the pedagogical stool. So we go from Memrise, a great way to memorize words, to a company that can then throw you in an ocean of content that you have a chance of understanding. And then we can let you practice using those words in conversation without the fear of human judgment, because you're talking to a robot, not a human being.
Right. Yeah. Wow. My goodness. I'm sure that helps a lot. It would help someone like myself, in fact, because as you had said, that early learner, getting over your ego, right, and sounding like an idiot when you're talking to another person. If I'm talking to a chatbot and I know it, then that would probably help me be okay feeling a little dumb in that moment. So that's amazing. You all are doing a lot of really neat stuff on the back end. So let me ask you this. You had mentioned one of the guys was a Grandmaster Memory Champion.
Yep.
That's Would you Ed mind Cook. Explaining what that is?
Yeah. Well, you may have heard of some of these memory contests where you have to memorize 4 shuffled decks of cards in order in a certain period of time. You have to, do various different memory exercises that really test how quickly you can, learn and retain things. You've probably seen shows where people remember everybody's name in the audience in very short order. And they have actual, contests to test that skill. And one of the bigger contests is the, U.S. Memory Championship. And Ed Cook, one of our founders, won that championship one year. It happened to be a year where a New York Times columnist named Joshua Foer was watching the event. And afterwards, he came up to Ed and said, I mean, that's amazing. You have just this skill that, you know, normal human beings don't have. And I was like, no, we've all got it. I can teach it to you. And so thus began a year collaboration where Joshua Foer, you know, worked with Ed and some other folks. And Joshua came back the next year and won the contest.
Wow.
And then he wrote the book Moonwalking with Einstein, which was a New York Times bestseller, on the backs of that experience. So it is a great, great origin story and a very, very clear reason why this company is named the way it is, even though we have transcended that one aspect of learning a language.
Yeah, that's fascinating. I'll pick that book up and give it a read. I'm always looking for books that I can add to my list, trying to consume those as many as I can to help me improve as an individual. So that is fascinating. So that memory aspect then, so you'd mentioned that a couple of things, right? The first one was AI to break down words and phrases and TikTok in videos, YouTube videos, right? How do you choose which videos? Because you had said that kind of tailors the skill level of the videos to the individual. Do you do that at random or just try and pick popular ones? Or how do you go about doing that?
Yeah, that is a good question. And there is a continuum that we are on at the moment as to how we choose them. The front end of the continuum, where we started this journey, was we took the linguists that are, you know, in our company today and have been the heart and soul of how we produce the content that we produce. And we had those linguists go out into YouTube and TikTok and find the videos that would be good and appropriate for what we are trying to accomplish. And as we ingest them, we match these words and phrases to our dictionary. But as you might imagine, sometimes there are words and phrases that are in these videos that are not in our dictionary. And yeah. So what we've had to do at that point in time is say, okay, if some words and phrases start appearing frequently, and they're usually slang in a given language, if they appear frequently, we need to get them into our dictionary. And when we bring something into our dictionary, there needs to be audio files associated with it, video files, and so on. But we continue to expand our dictionary so that more and more videos out there become candidates for being, you know, brought in. So that's the first step of our journey. The second step of our journey is now that we have a, you know, a greatly expanded dictionary, how about if we start to scoop up videos wholesale and try and figure out whether there are reasons why we would screen something out? So before we picked each one individually and said, okay, this is a good video, let's bring it in. Now we start to scoop up things in groups and say, what are reasons why we might filter it out? Whether, you know, when we break down the words and phrases, the content's just not consistent with the kind of content we want to have in our world for whatever reason. Or we have scooped up something that is got too high a degree of difficulty. You know, this 1 2-minute video has, you know, 150 words in it, and only 10 of them are in our dictionary because it is a, you know, very, you know, heady intellectual video, and so on. So we start to filter things out. And the final step of our journey, which we're implementing now, is how do we go and actively seek the videos that we want? And that is going to be driven based on the words our users have learned. So each user learns different words at a different pace. And we can then have a computer look at these words and say, hey, these videos over here, are these users over here? Heck, Grant over here has 500 words mastered, but he's only really got 50 videos that he can immerse himself in where he knows at least half of the words. So we got to go find videos that have these words in them, you know, from Grant's, you know, Dictionary of Mastered Words. And that's going to be our next leg of the journey, where we can proactively stuff our product with videos based on what our users, you know, need based on the words they've learned. And the final leg of the journey can be, okay, it's clear that Grant likes learning French with football. So let's go get some more football videos for Grant, ingest them into our system and give it to him. So we are halfway through that continuum now.
Okay, excellent. That's a really good angle. I hadn't considered that the type of content in the videos would be a driving factor for someone being excited to learn the language, but it makes a lot of sense too at the same time. So more of a technical question for you here, and if this is a trade secret, then obviously you don't have to share it with me, but I've done a lot of work in like text-to-speech and speech-to-text and in like waveform processing. And one of the things that has always stood out to me as I've looked at different languages, I'll use Japanese as an example here, like the word konnichiwa, right? When you write it out in the character set for Japanese, it is actually spelled konnichiwa. But the way you verbalize that and the way that you read it natively in the language is different. So I wanted to ask, you say dictionary. Does that consist of like phonemes or waveforms or the text language itself, or how, what does that dictionary look like?
Yes. So the very short answer is yes, it consists of that. What has distinguished Memrise over the years is that when all of us teach words and help you memorize words, we have always filled our lessons with videos of native speakers saying the words. So we've got Spanish people saying, you know, hola and donde esta, and French people saying bonjour and ça va, and, you know, Japanese people saying konnichiwa. When we film that, we have video with an audio file, and we can parse the audio file off the video so we can give tests that are audio only, not video as well. So when we teach konnichiwa, when we first present that word to you, it is usually presented with a native speaker looking you right in the eye and saying konnichiwa. And that's how we get there. Now, Japanese is a script language as well. And so some people want to learn the actual symbols for konnichiwa, while others just don't want to do that at all and just want to have the Latin, you know, Latinized phonetic spelling. And we provide both of them for script languages like Chinese and Japanese and Korean. But we also have a native speaker saying it for you, because that is the most important part of the immersive experience in learning a language like you're in country.
Yeah, excellent. So let's see here. Moving on. There's so many different topics I want to hit all at the same time with you. So bear with me as I hit kind of scattershot on a couple of things. So one of the features of the app that I noticed that was interesting to me was the Explore feature, right? You can take your phone and it opens the camera. You can see different objects and it translates those in real time into like the words associated with that object.
Right.
Would you mind talking a little bit about how that operates? I assume there's a like an AI model behind that that does the conversion.
Yeah.
But what does that look like technically?
So that feature is, you know, been with us for a little while, and it is built on the augmented reality tool set that exists within, you know, the Apple native environment and Xcode and so on. So we have you know, libraries and libraries and libraries. So when the camera looks at a room with desks and chairs and a TV and a laptop and a book and pens in it, we're drawing upon the, you know, augmented reality libraries that are out there that says, okay, that's a pen, that's a desk, and so on. And we're getting that information in the form of English words. And then we have our dictionaries, where we have a language pairing of English to Spanish and English to French and English to Portuguese and English to Korean and so on and so forth. So that's how that works. So we rely on augmented reality models and to give us the word, and then we translate the word into the language that the user is looking to learn.
Okay. Do you own any of those models yourselves, or do you just use what's available in the industry right now?
Yeah, we use what's available in the industry. Okay. In much the same way as we are using large language models, in this particular case, ChatGPT or GPT 3.5 is what we're using right now for our bot. The interesting thing, and this could be a whole podcast unto itself, but I often have people go, okay, well, if you're just using OpenAI's tech, what are you bringing to the party here? And the answer is the prompt engineering, right?
Okay.
We need to prompt these systems to not only assume certain roles, we also need to prompt it to accomplish certain objectives, and we need to design it in such a way that the computer itself can determine whether the objective is met. So, for example, one of our more popular missions is to go into a coffee shop and order a cup of coffee. And what we're finding, as a total aside, is people just love to use that for batting practice, right? They show up in Barcelona and they're like, okay, I'm wake up and I'm going to go and run the coffee, mission 10 mm-hmm. times. I'm like, okay, I've just gone and successfully ordered a cup of coffee 10 times. Now I'm going to go down to the lobby and order one. And so that is what becomes possible with this. But back to the prompt engineering, what we need to do is set the environment so we can say you're a barista in Barcelona, mm-hmm. and you are and the mission is the person's going to come in and order a cup of coffee, and you have to have an interchange that can go in any direction based on whatever they say. And when they give you enough information such that you can reliably give them the thing that they want, the latte mm-hmm. or cappuccino, whatever it may be, you need to declare that the goal has been met and say congratulations. And so all of that prompting and crafting useful scenarios is where we come into play. This is what we layer on top of GPT, and this is where we make it useful for our particular use case and put the guardrails on to make sure that we don't have, a racist chatbot running wild in our system.
Absolutely. There have been a few of those that have popped up in the world.
There have been, right? Microsoft has famously unleashed one on Twitter many years ago.
Exactly. Good things to avoid. Exactly. So that is fascinating. You're right. I bet that could be a whole podcast episode in and of itself. So if you don't mind talking a little bit more about this whole idea of missions, do you create all of those missions or prompts kind of through a person in iteration, or do you rely? I know there are some people who've used ChatGPT to generate its own prompts for missions, for example. How do you go about generating those?
So the generation of missions, like our ingestion of video content, has been a continuum. It started with us just sitting down and starting to prompt the system and figuring out what makes for a good prompt and what makes for a bad prompt. What barn doors do we leave wide open for bad things happening, and what things do we need to watch for? What makes for an easy mission versus a hard mission? For example, go into the coffee shop in Barcelona and order a coffee is an easy mission. Go into the coffee shop in Barcelona, order a coffee, and get the barista's phone number, that's a harder mission, right?
Yep.
but it also makes for a more fun mission, to be sure. So this is how we started. Once we got familiar with what makes for a good mission and what makes for a bad mission, it became clear that there's got to be some sort of goal, not just an open-ended conversation. It's got to be some sort of goal that you're working towards. So the next thing we did was say, okay, how can we get the bot to understand a goal and mm-hmm. when it is met? Because we need the bot itself to look at every interaction and decide, did I meet the goal? Not yet. Keep the conversation going. Did I meet the goal? Not yet. Keep the conversation going until you eventually get to the point where you have met the goal. So that is, where the next step in the evolution, which is have the bot itself understand the goal. Then from there, we started to say, okay, now, ChatGPT, come up with ideas on your own. What would be a good idea for a mission, right? And so we get kernels of ideas generated by this technology. And then we say, okay, now that you have come up with an idea, how can you run a whole bunch of missions on your own? Not have somebody type through, look at it, assess, run a whole bunch of missions on your own, knowing what the end goal is, and decide when you have a good mission or when you have a bad mission. You can literally get the system to have a conversation with itself in much the same way that chess computers have played chess games with themselves and learn from that within some sort of parameters, which is if you can't have a conversation that leads to a successful goal after 10 exchanges, you probably got something going on wrong here. So, what proves a successful win in the system. So that's the continuum that we've been on, and there's a lot of nuance to all of it, but those particular examples should be good waypoints in the road that makes our journey somewhat understandable.
Yeah, right. So with ChatGPT in particular, I'm familiar with the API. I've used a lot of that in my spare time. And are you using the base model, or have you all fine-tuned your own model? Because you talk about it training itself, right? So are you trying to create your own model that could do those missions better than maybe the base model can?
So no, we are taking their base model, which keeps improving. Because they are feeding it with unbelievable amounts of data, and they're presiding over its evolution with some of the smartest, PhDs in data science that are out there. So they will forever be ahead of the game in terms of evolving the base model. What we do is put the layer over top of it that channels this base model into things that are useful for our customers, right? It is not particularly useful to our customers to write a 20-page doctoral thesis on the history of salt. That's not a use case that we have. And it's, but it is a useful use case for us to have good conversations that are likely to happen in your day-to-day interaction with the world, using a new language. So that's where our customization comes into play, is that layer over top of it. So we're only using a tiny fraction of the possibilities that this base model provides. But the base model is so darn good that we don't need to evolve the base model. We just need to channel it through the right filter for our users.
Yeah, it is amazing. I did an episode on GPT-3 before it became 3.5, I think. It was about a month ago, right? This thing has been evolving so rapidly. Yeah. And I thought it was neat because it already supports many different languages. So there probably shouldn't be a whole lot of work you need to do with it other than that base prompt generation for the bot, right? So what makes for a good prompt in this case?
Yep. So there is a good prompt from the standpoint of getting GPT or any large language model to do what you want it to do. And there's a good prompt in creating a mission that is interesting to our users, right? So we could do a good prompt for GPT by being very specific, such as, okay, you see the world only through the lens of Kierkegaard. In fact, you are Kierkegaard. Mm-hmm. Give us your, you know, point of view on, you know, the best way to order a coffee in Barcelona, right? That you know, is a good prompt in its specificity to by saying you are Kierkegaard, but useless for our use case, and certainly probably not interesting to any of our users, right? Mm-hmm. So I divide the, you know, the good prompt into those two categories. So category one is when it comes to GPT, specificity, right? Okay. What is it that you are and what is it that you are not, right? So that, to stick with the example, that barista in Barcelona clearly speaks Spanish, you know, or perhaps Catalan. right? Let's say the barista's in Madrid.
okay, right? There we go.
clearly speaks Spanish, and we can also say what you're not, because when a person comes into the coffee shop and the barista says, "What can I get you?" and they say, "I'm having an existential crisis. You can really get me the meaning of life so that I understand what's going on," right? We don't allow the bot to go down that rabbit hole, even though they could, right? So our bots say, "Well, I can't really help you with that, but I can get you a cup of Joe," right? So what specificity in what it is and what it is not is very important in prompting the tech. And missions that people like is really important for what people like. And here I've got an interesting story that is born from our data. What we have found, and this part won't be a surprise to you, is that when we lay out our missions, the missions that people encounter first on the page, as opposed to those they encounter when they scroll a bit, have more, you know, usage, right? The ones at the top have more usage right. than the ones at the bottom as a whole. Mm-hmm. And we started with very utilitarian missions. Order a cup of coffee, go into the grocery store and, you know, pick up some groceries, get a train ticket at the train station, and so on. But around Valentine's Day, we started putting a few more in, like, how do you say I love you without saying that I love you? Mm-hmm. And how do you start a conversation with a stranger? And even when those missions were positioned lower on the page, which has historically had less traction, they instantly got more usage. Mm. Which is a very interesting thing to see. And it was such a distinct blip in our data that it became clear to us, or we think it's clear to us, that the reason people want to learn another language is to connect with other human beings, right? Mm-hmm. That's why they want to do it. They don't want to do it because they want to just say, "I speak French." And they certainly don't want to do it so that they can, you know, play Candy Crush with language on their mobile phone. They want to be able to connect with other human beings, which is, you know, a great thing as far as we're concerned. And so we have now started to say, okay, how do we make more missions about connecting with other people? How do you talk to your in-laws at, you know, Christmas or Hanukkah, or, you know, mm-hmm. and so on? So it's an interesting thing that our usage patterns by our users have made clear something that we always thought was true, that people want to speak to connect with other humans.
Yeah, there definitely seems to be also even a seasonal component to language learning as well. Like as things come up that are topical in people's lives, it's like, oh, hey, that is driving me, giving me maybe the motivation to pick up another language to connect with people.
Yeah.
That's good absolutely. Stuff. Let's see here. You had mentioned a lot of very unique ways that you are utilizing AI and technology to build the business of Memrise. Are you taking any steps to protect the business, especially with this whole mission-based language learning? Are there any ways you can protect yourself so that other companies don't just say, oh, that's a good idea, let's do the same thing and copy that feature for our users?
So the answer is yes, but not on a feature-by-feature level. What we are doing to protect our business is we're just building a better mousetrap that's more effective by addressing all three legs of the pedagogical stool, right? Mm-hmm. You can learn and you can memorize words with us or Duolingo. Duolingo is a great app for memorizing words. They are, in many respects, the ultimate flashcard company. They have gamified that to such a impressive level that they are the 800-pound gorilla in the space. And they've just done a fantastic job with that. Tip of the hat to them. And on top of all of that, they've done it for noble purposes. They want to educate the world, and I think that's a beautiful thing. But they're flashcards. Right, they don't have a way to throw you in to infinite sea of video content filtered by the words that you have learned, even though they know what every one of their users has learned when they've gotten to level 3, because mm-hmm. every user in their world learns the same words in the same order, and that's why you get kind of funky phrases like the turtle is on my shoulder, when you're working with them. So we immediately defend ourselves with our architecture, allowing you to learn whatever words you want to, and a sea of content. So no matter what words you have learned, you can immerse yourself in content. And then coupling that with, okay, if you want to go learn, learn to order a coffee, here's the words to learn to order coffee. Here's the videos to listen about people ordering coffee. Here's the place to practice ordering coffee. And we get all three legs of the stool. Mm-hmm. People can build the exact same bot that we built, but they can't help people learn the words that you need to make the bot work. They can't give you a whole ton of video content to hear the conversations that might happen in a coffee shop in order to train your ear. So the connectivity of our learning journey of learning words and knowing what words they are and immersing you in video and then bringing you to the right mission based on the words you're learning. If you're looking to travel by train around Europe, well, let's make sure you know how to handle yourself in a train station. And if you're looking to go to the next World Cup, wherever it may be hosted, learn the language related to football and so on. So that's where our defense comes, not in that we can prevent somebody from replicating our mm-hmm. chatbot. That can be done. You just can't get the other two legs of the stool without, doing all that we've done to date. And that's harder to replicate.
Yeah, absolutely. So just doing it better than your competitors is what I'm hearing. It reducing that friction for somebody to learn a language. And as of yet, I don't think there's a tool that will do the work for you. So it's really about making that process enjoyable for the language learner and easier for them. So it kind of scales with their skill, right? Yep. You don't go into a gym and expect to bench press 200 pounds immediately. Right. You got to meet the user where they're at and then kind of help build them up to whatever their target goal is. So that makes a lot of sense in protecting yourself by doing that better than the competition. So we're coming up here. I know you've got another thing to run off to here. So I want to be respectful of your time. But if you've got a few more minutes, knowing everything that you know now in your career has taken you very far. What advice would you give to yourself when you were just starting out early, right after college or high school or when you were starting your career?
That's a good question. I think that the one thing that has become clear along the way is the thing that you must know, the thing that's going to take over the world, the thing that everybody has to wrap their brain around, changes faster and faster and faster, right? Right. We just, what was once the only way to do things, whether it be the given programming language, whether it be given the right infrastructure, configuration, whether it is a given management technique, none of them seem to stand the test of time. They, rise up in popularity and utility. We absorb them, we build upon them, and something new rises up. So just, get ready to, ride wave after wave after wave. Don't get overly obsessed with the next one. It is a longer journey, and being flexible is going to stand you in great stead.
Right. And with flexibility, especially with AI coming, it seems to be consuming every aspect of our lives. What's your feeling on AI right now? Does it make you nervous? Are you seeing it headed for making the world a better place for humanity? Or do you have any concerns with this as it starts to grow its own path in the world?
Yeah, this is again, another, whole podcast that really is an area of deep interest for me. I am concerned about certain aspects of our society, right? And how the tools that we have built that allow one to recommend, soccer cleats to somebody who just bought a soccer jersey, has been used with malicious intent to recommend a, flat earth theory to somebody who said, what's this crazy QAnon group? And we are somehow narrow casting and leaving everybody with their own set of facts that makes it hard for us to come together, as a society. But these tools only exacerbate something that we, the people, need to ultimately solve at a more, higher intellectual level. So this exacerbation that these tools are bringing about will hopefully shock us into saying, hey, we gotta stop being two standard deviations from the center on either side and taking pot shots at each other. We gotta come together and say, okay, let's set some ground rules for the use of these tools. But we will never get there if we just say, press pause on AI development and exploration, because, that's never gonna work. We're never gonna get other countries to press pause. And it's just a silly way to go about it. I don't believe that we are, a year away from computers reaching sentience and, taking over. I do accept that there is a path where sentience could potentially happen, and there could be, ill side effects, to say the least, but I don't think that's around the corner.
Okay. I agree with you on that one. I've listened to a lot of other podcasts that discuss whether or not GPT-4 is already sentient, or at least the emergence of artificial general intelligence, or AGI. And I personally don't think that's the case yet either. I think in this episode, I even referred to the large language model as a chatbot, right? So no offense intended to anybody listening to this who believes otherwise, but I'm not quite sold on that idea yet. So I love what you said, though. You see and mentioned the picture behind me. It says, work hard and be kind. I think a challenge for everybody listening to this is to work hard to be kind as well, especially since there's such a variety of opinions in the world. As you said, two standard deviations away from the norm. that gap is growing, it seems, in these past couple of years. And especially with Memrise, trying to help bridge that communication gap, I think is a good thing, so that we can all understand more about what we're actually saying to each other rather than bringing in our own baggage to that conversation. So thank you for everything you are doing in the world to help bridge that communication gap in the spirit in which you're doing it with. And thank you very much for spending your time with me today.
It was a pleasure. I really enjoyed the conversation. I'm glad that you invited me.
My thanks again to Steve and his team at Memrise for coordinating this episode. It was a joy spending time with him, and I appreciate the insight he gave us into his business. For everyone listening, I hope you got as much value out of that discussion as I did. I certainly learned a lot myself. If you're wanting to be a guest on my podcast next, please reach out. Or if you want to sponsor it or have a specific technology topic that you want me to cover, don't be a stranger. Connect with me on LinkedIn at grantdryden.com or drop me an email. I'd love to talk. And with that, thank you for listening, and I'll see you again next time.